Obama, maybe I should tell the story how I met Ed. In 1963, I was living in Germany. I met what is now my ex-husband, Mick Hamilton, who was an American. He was in the Air Force in Germany. And after he was discharged from the forces, we were thinking that I might go to the United States with him, and we would live here. But that didn't work out so well because I had gone to Morocco during that year, and in Morocco I went there to buy pot to my marijuana, which I did, and I brought back to Germany, and I sold to American soldiers. That was my income. I was also going to school, and that was sort of my side income. And unfortunately, the German authorities, being as they are, caught me doing this. And though my sentence was very light, they gave me 2 weekends to work in a sort of a mental hospital kind of setting. And actually 2 weekends in jail and 30 hours to work in a mental hospital so I could go to school at the same time. It wouldn't interfere with my school. But it resulted in my having a police record. So the American Immigration Office said that I could not go to the United States because I had a police record for having used drugs. So that not being a possibility, we ran into a Persian man who took Mercedes cars from Frankfurt to Iran, sold them there, and bought carpets and brought the carpets back to Germany. This is how he was making his money. And he invited us to drive with him to Iran and take a couple of these cars to Iran, and he would pay us some money for that. So we drove these two Mercedes cars for the Iranian fellow with him to Tehran, and he paid us $200 when we got there. And he had paid our way. He paid for the hotel and the gasoline and the food on the way. And so we found ourselves in Asia with $200. We originally had about $20 when we left. So when we got to Tehran, we had somewhere around $200, and that seemed a considerable amount of money to us. And we had a knapsack and a sleeping bag and a change of clothes, and that was about it. So we thought about it for a while. What should we do now? And the idea of going back to Germany was totally unattractive, and we couldn't come to the United States. And yet, beyond Iran, there's Asia, and that seemed like very exciting. So at that point, I knew so little about Asia that I thought Nepal was a city. And so somehow, I really didn't know. I thought beyond Tehran, we're going to have to fight tigers and lions or something like that. I thought it was really very wild, and to my surprise, I discovered that Asia is very civilized, as a matter of fact. So we never did fight lions or tigers. But we started hitchhiking from Tehran, and meanwhile, it's 1964, and we went east. And we were in not any particular hurry because we really weren't going anywhere, so we just took our time and hitchhiked. When someone would pick us up, we'd take a ride, and when somebody would invite us into their homes, we would stay with them. And we very slowly sort of moved across Asia, and we practically spent no money because people in Asia are extremely hospitable, and people would invite us into their homes all the time, and we didn't pay for transportation, and we really had barely any expenses. But what we did do with our $200, we bought watches, and they were $3 each. They were the cheapest thing you've ever seen. And we took those $3 watches, and we took them to Pakistan, and we sold them there for much more, I don't know, something like $15, $20, whatever it was, I can't remember. So we increased our $200, plus the fact that we didn't spend very much money. And this sort of became the general trend of our travel, we were what you would commonly call smugglers. We bought things in one country and took them to another country and sold them for a profit. And that's how we maintained. And this is just quite easy to do, actually. There are always commodities such as cheap watches or anything, really, that one can take from one country to another and sell it and make a fairly decent profit at it. So when we got to India, we were sort of attracted by the Ganges River, and we went to... Somehow we thought that that sort of sounded... Now, we didn't really know anything about spiritual life. I was raised a Catholic, and I rejected Catholicism as soon as I was old enough to think. I really didn't think it made any sense to me. And I had talks with the priest, and he could never answer my questions properly, and so I just said, no. And I never really gave God a thought. But somehow the Ganges had sort of an attraction to us. So we went, and we traveled all along the Ganges. And we spent quite a number of months there. And we were very attracted to these Indian yogis and holy men, the sadhus, and these people that would live by the side of the river. They wear orange robes, and they're in some cases quite bizarre people, actually. Some are naked, and some have long matted hair, and really a strange crew of people. And so Mick, in fact, liked them so much that he started wearing orange robes himself, though he really had no idea what that meant, not a clear idea what that meant. It was just sort of the thing to do. So he discarded his Western clothes, and he started going about in these orange robes. Now, I never went to this extent. I just continued wearing my jeans and work shirt and so on. So consequently, what the Indians thought was that he looked like one of those sadhus by the river, and he had long hair and a beard, and I looked, I guess, fairly normal. So they thought I was his disciple. He was the guru, and I was his disciple because he kind of looked like a swami or a sadhu or something. So he was trekking along. And the reason why we really got so fond of the sadhus and the swamis was because, well, swami, not really, but the sadhus and the yogis, because they lived very much like we did, we thought. They lived by taking things from other people. People would feed them. People would give them shelter. And in a lot of cases, they don't really want shelter. They just sit by the river. And the one thing that they did that made us very compatible was they loved to smoke dope. And that is what we did every day, all day. And so here we had found our compadres. They were sort of, to us, they were really like the Western-style beatniks. This was a little bit before the hippie era. They were just like beatniks in the West. They sort of had their society conned into believing they were holy. And so people fed them and took care of them. But yet what they really like to do is sit by the river and get stoned, just like that. And so we stayed with them by the river for a while and got stoned. And then we went on, and we went to Southeast Asia and stayed there for a while. And we were not very much in touch with the world as the world sort of goes. We were kind of living in our own kind of created reality. For instance, we went to Vietnam, and we were really surprised. We thought, "Boy, this place is really a drag." I mean, they were having a full-blown war there. I mean, we knew that sort of. You know, we'd seen a Time magazine or something like that, but we really didn't really grasp the fact that this place was being bombed. Not only did we go there, but we went there twice. And here we were, Mick is still in his orange robes, of course, and with his long beard and hair, and now all these poor GIs, they were all about 18, 19 years old, really young guys. I was terrible, and they'd say, what are you doing here? What is this? They couldn't figure out what on earth we were doing there. And so finally we got to Japan, and in Japan we thought that we might try to go from Japan to the United States because it's a long way from Germany, and probably they don't know anything about my police record. So we went to the American embassy, and they said, oh, yes, you write away to your hometown, and there you get your police record, and when you get your police record, you bring it to us, and then we'll talk about an immigration visa. So I obviously knew what my police record looked like, and we said, all right, forget it, and we never went back. And so we were sort of at the end of a road. There's not any place to go from Japan if you can't go to the United States except back. So we thought about it, and at this point we had a fair bit of money because we had taken several pounds of drugs from Nepal to Japan, which we sold to American Air Force personnel in Japan. So we were financially in pretty good shape. And so we decided, well, let's go back to India. And so we went back to Southeast Asia, back through Vietnam, and went to Thailand and Cambodia and all over the place. And in Singapore, we were traveling by boat from Hong Kong to Saigon to Singapore. And when we came back from Bangkok and Cambodia, we went back to Singapore. We heard that there was a woman in Singapore that she was staying at the Sikh temple. Sikhs are the Indians, that the Sikh religion, that wear the turbans. And one of the things in the Sikh religion is that you must give shelter to people who are in need. And so Sikh temples open their doors to people who need a place to stay. And they don't give anything. I mean, it's a floor in a temple. But when you have a sleeping bag, at least it's a roof over your head. So the Sikh temples were very popular with other hitchhikers like us as a place to stay. And this lady at the Sikh temple, I knew her. I met her in Paris in the early 60s. She was Austrian. And we had heard that she was there. So we went to the Sikh temple, and she was there. And I was a big hello here. We were in Singapore, and the last time I saw her was in Paris. And she went out with us outside, and we went opposite to a tea stall and had some tea. And in our usual way, we lit a joint, you know, some pot, and passed it to her. And with her was this fellow. And so we passed it to him, and he said, no, thank you, I'm trying not to take drugs. And he was American. And he said, what? What are you talking about? And he said, well, that he has a teacher in India by the name of Meher Baba. In fact, he's on his way to India to meet Meher Baba. And Meher Baba does not like drugs. And he said, this is weird. And so we said, have you ever been to India? And he said, no, he'd never been to India. And he said, look, I mean, if you like drugs and if you want to use drugs, then just find yourself another Baba. There are hundreds of Babas in India. And if your Baba doesn't like drugs, just get okay, find another Baba. And this somehow didn't seem to sink in. He wasn't too impressed by that. So he said, no, it's okay. And so we spent time with him, and with our Austrian friend. In fact, we went on from Singapore to Ceylon, and he wanted to go to Bombay to meet Meher Baba, and it was in 1965 at this point. And he didn't have any money. He was out of money. So for some reason, that wasn't our normal, natural way. We paid his way. We gave him money for his ticket. And ordinarily, it's just not done. I mean, on the road, people that live on the road, you don't pay someone else's way because everybody's sort of on their own. You know. But I don't know why we did that. He seemed to be so insistent that he had to get to India by November of 65. And I don't know when this was. It was maybe September or something like that. That we bought him a ship ticket from Singapore to Bombay. And now the girl, she also wanted to go back to Europe. She had no interest in, she had no knowledge of Meher Baba. She just happened to know this fellow. And she also wanted to go back to Europe. So what we did is we paid Steve's way, his name was Steve, and we took the girl in our cabin on the ship and we stowed her away on the ship. She hid in our closet, in Mick and my cabin. She hid the closet. And it was fine. They never caught her. And every day I would take this food from the dining room table and I'd bring it up to my cabin. And I was sure they knew because they kept giving me more and more food. But I don't know. I don't know if they did or not. So But we got off in Ceylon, and Steve went on, and he stowed her the rest of the way to Bombay in his cabin. And as we heard later, Steve did get to meet Baba in November of 65. And we got off in Singapore, in Ceylon. Now, I don't remember anything that Steve told us about Baba, except that he doesn't like drugs. And I think that's really all. I don't even have any recollection whether he told us that he was silent, and I certainly don't recall anything having been said about the avatar. So to us, really, we liked Steve, but what his likes were and what his Baba was, it just kind of went. We didn't think about it again as soon as we parted ways with Steve. So we went to Ceylon for about 6 weeks, and there our travels kind of sort of came to a halt. We started getting really tired and really just sort of exhausted, and going somewhere didn't seem to make sense anymore. It was like, oh, let's go here. What for? No, let's just sit. And somehow these years of just running around the world and traveling had sort of taken its toll, and we just sat in the lobby of this place where we were staying. It was some kind of sailor's mission or something. They had real cheap rooms there. And so we stayed there. We sat in the lobby for 6 weeks, and we just smoked our pot and hash or whatever it was, and we just sat in this lobby looking at the 6 weeks. And opposite there was a wholesale pharmaceutical company. And they had in Colombo. They had a sign outside, a red neon sign that says, Drugs Limited. You know, limited being like ink or something in English, right? And so that sign flashed on and off, Drugs Limited. And we sat in this lobby and we looked at the sign for 6 weeks as it was going, noing, noing. And it just sort of never sunk in, but later, of course, we remembered. And so then we decided, look, this is no good. Let's just go to India. India somehow in our mind sort of started to become the promised land. What we were going to do when we get to India, we really didn't know. But somehow we knew that Southeast Asia and all that really wasn't where it was at. Definitely India was where it's at. So let's go back to India. Now, meanwhile, Mick, of course, through Japan, throughout Southeast Asia, is still in orange robes. And Mick, someone had given him a copy of the Bhagavad Gita in Japan, in English. And he was reading that. And he would read that all the time. He read that for months together. And I never thought about reading it. My English wasn't such that I could really understand it. Mick's German was just about perfect, and we spoke German, and I just didn't speak English very well at that time. And also, I really didn't have any interest in it. We met with people, we had long sort of religious discussions with Buddhists of Southeast Asia and so on, and in India, of course, or in the Middle East when we were coming that way with Islam. So we had a fair idea about different religions, but the only thing that I remember that made sense to me was reincarnation. I remember we would sit with an old Buddhist lady, and she had explained, it was a Thailand, I think, she had explained to us about reincarnation. I thought that made more sense than anything I'd ever heard. So I liked that idea, and I decided that that's what was happening. But I really gave no further thought to searching or finding God or anything. So we went from Ceylon to India by boat. And when we arrived in Bombay, as we were pulling into the port, we somehow decided that maybe we should stop taking drugs. We had been taking drugs a lot. And also, while we were in Southeast Asia, we'd been taking opiates quite a bit. And every day. And we thought, maybe this is really sort of a drag, and maybe we should stop taking drugs. And so we had this resolution. It was the 31st of December, and 65. So we had this resolution. It was a New Year's resolution. We are going to stop taking drugs. And so we got off the boat, and we got some tiny little room in Bombay. It was really a flea bag. For like a dollar a night or some horrible place, I remember. And then we walked down the street, and it was about 10 o'clock in the evening, and there was this sandstone kind of fountain in a roundabout in the middle of the road where different roads come in, and the fountain didn't have any water in it. And so we sat on the edge of the fountain, and we just sort of watched the traffic in India. And this fellow sitting next to Mick is messing around, and it was pretty obvious he was filling a pipe with hash, and so an Indian. And so he passed it on to Mick. He said, "Brother, would you like some?" He said, "Sure." So our New Year's resolution didn't even go into the New Year. It just already got broken before midnight even. And so we sat with this fellow, and we smoked the stuff, and we didn't sleep in the fountain. We would go to our little hotel, but we spent about 3 weeks in this fountain. That we went there in the morning, and we sat with these people, and we talked with them, and we just sort of hung out with them and smoked with them. And we'd sit there all day, every day, for 3 weeks. And they were untouchables. They were just the absolute, just the lowest of the society. One guy had one arm, and the other guy was just weird people. And we'd sit with them, and we'd smoke hash with them, and we'd just kind of look at Bombay, throngs of people going by. And it sort of became pretty obvious that we were getting really our life was just sort of coming to some kind of an end there. We had no energy, we had no desire, we had no motivation, we had nothing. We just sat in this fountain with these sort of dregs of humanity getting stoned. And so one day, one of them said, we got to go somewhere. Got to get out of here. So one of them, he was a Muslim, he said, "You've got to go to Hyderabad. Hyderabad is wonderful, lovely town. You must see Hyderabad." So we said, "Oh, great, okay." So now suddenly we had an aim, we had a place to go, so we packed our stuff up and we left for Hyderabad. I mean, we were that impressionable. It was, anyone could have said anything wrong, sure, we do it. I'm just sort of following. And so we went. And on our way to Hyderabad, we hitchhiked. Then on our way to Hyderabad, some truck or whatever picked us up, took us as far as Pune. And we checked into a little hotel by the train station for the night. And the next day, we remembered that Pune is the place where Steve Simon had told us that Mahabharata is. And we said, "All right, maybe we should go see this guy. You know, it's a town, sounds like a good thing to do." So we asked the hotel, "Where does Mahabharata live?" And he said, "Oh, he lives just down the road here in Guru Prasad on Bunt Garden Road." So we said, "Okay, great, let's go see him." So we got into a rickshaw and we buzzed down Bunt Garden Road, and here's this palace. And if most of you probably have seen photos of Guru Prasad, it is a really beautiful place. And this sort of shocked us, because the holy men that we had seen, that we were used to, didn't live in places like this. It was amazing to us. So we walked in the gate, and this old man came up to us, and we asked him if he was Mahabharata. And he said, "No, I'm just the gardener." So, okay. And he said that Mahabharata wasn't there, that Mahabharata lived 90 miles north of Pune, at a place called Ahmednagar, and that we should go to the Pune Baba Center, and there we would get more information, because the Guru Prasad, this building was actually closed now. So he walked us out, and he put us in the rickshaw, and he gave the rickshaw the address to go to the Baba Center in Pune. And to me, this was sort of almost a little bit too much effort already. It was like, well, he's not here, let's go. You know, we're going to Hyderabad. But we were on our way to the Pune Center, so it was okay. And we walked in, and that's where we saw our first Baba picture. It was a painting, a full life-size painting at the end of the hall. And Baba was young, and his hair was open. And so we walked up there, and we looked at it. The place was empty, and we looked at it. And I remember Mick was really surprised that Baba didn't have a beard, that he shaved, a holy man who wouldn't bother to shave. And I was sort of taken by his nose. His big nose was the first thing I noticed. And so just as we're standing there, this fellow comes in, and he, Ramakrishnan, he ran the Pune Center, and he asked what we were doing. And we told him that we had gone to the other place to see Meher Baba, and he said, well, that Meher Baba is seeing no one at this time, that he's in very strict seclusion, but if we want to, he would send a message to Baba, and we should come back in 3 days, and we'll see what Baba says, but at this point he's in seclusion. So we said, okay, you do that. You send the message. And then we left, and then we decided, oh, let's just forget about it. Let's go on to Hyderabad. We were going to Hyderabad. We actually had a mission there. And so we left Pune on our way to Hyderabad, and we never went back to see what the answer of the message would be. We never went back 3 years later. And so on our way to Hyderabad, some fellow picked us up in a jeep, and he said, where are you going? And we said, we're going to Hyderabad. And he said, why? He said, we don't know. And he said, oh, I think, this is just some Indian man. He said, let's have chai. So we had tea. And then he said, I think you should go back to Bombay. And we said, really? You think so? He said, oh, yes, I think you should go back to Bombay. He said, oh, okay. So we walked across the street and stuck our thumbs out and hitchhiked back to Bombay. We were extremely impressionable. So we got back to the fountain. Everybody, hey, what are you doing? Farhad, how was Hyderabad? Well, we never got to Hyderabad. So, oh, I see. So we sat in the fountain some more with our friends in the fountain and smoked some more dope and kind of looked at Bombay. And then Mick decided, this is no good. We've got to do something with our life. Let's go to Delhi. We really like Delhi, and Delhi's wonderful. We've been there before. So we packed up and we went to Delhi. Well, we were going to go to Delhi, and we got lost in Rajasthan. We went the wrong way, and we got lost in the Rajasthani desert, and it was just a drag. And life was really getting to be kind of, desperation was sort of setting in a little bit. There was, even though we were in India, what was supposed to be the promised land, it was just as confusing and just as nothing as anywhere else. Our life had really become very meaningless in a way. Now, Mick was still in his orange robes, and he was still reading the Bhagavad Gita. And the only thing that we did sort of religiously was get high every day. And so here we are wandering around the Rajasthani desert, and then finally someone picked us up and found us. And the man that found us took us to a Krishna temple in Rajasthan. And there was a big mela happening, some big celebration to Lord Krishna. And Mick went into the temple with this man, and I don't know, maybe the man went by himself and Mick went. And I was just getting out of the jeep to go into the temple, and some women came and stopped me. And a little while later, Mick came out, short while later, Mick came out. And he was really upset. And what had happened is that he had gone into the temple, and a bunch of people came, and they asked him if he was a Hindu. And he said, I'm no. And they said, you must leave. And he said, I want to stay. And they said, no, you can't stay. You must leave. You're not a Hindu. You have to leave. And he started getting very sort of threatening feeling. And so he left. And evidently why it upset him to such a degree was that he had been reading the Bhagavad Gita for months, and he'd been developing a certain love and feeling for Krishna through reading the Bhagavad Gita. And here, he had gone to a Krishna temple, and he was thrown out, and it was very upsetting to him. In fact, it was so upsetting to him, and he should really tell that side of the story, because I didn't have those feelings, that from that day on, he was absolutely impossible to be with. He just got really grouchy, really angry, really nervous, really upset. I mean, it was just impossible. I thought he was going mad. I couldn't figure out what was happening. And he would yell at people and throw things, and just not at all his normal way, but he just started getting really frustrated from that day on. And so we went on to Delhi, and I thought, well, maybe we should find a guru or something. And so we looked around a little bit. In fact, we actually at one point considered, there was a place that someone told us about in Bihar, in Ranchi, where one could learn how to levitate in a 6 weeks course. And we thought, hey, now that sounds like a good idea. Let's go and learn how to levitate. But then we sort of dismissed it. And I thought maybe we should go to Rishikesh or the Himalayas, you know, the caves up there, and find a guru. And Mick, so one day, said, I want to go see this Meher Baba. He said, "You what? Oh, come on." He said, "No, I want to go see Lena Bali." And so I couldn't believe it. I said, "Why? It was 800 miles the other way. We just came from there. We never even went back for the message," which was kind of a rude thing to do, you know. "And now you want to go back there? We don't know anything about this guy except that he doesn't like drugs. That's obviously what we seem to like the most. And, I mean, what, you know, let's go somewhere and find a guru." And for some reason, he seemed to be just insistent on it, and he said that's what he wants to do. And since he was in such a state, since he was in such an emotional state that was really quite different from the way he normally used to be, I thought, well, anything, as long as it seems to help him. So he wrote a letter He wrote a telegram to Baba, which he addressed, "Meher Baba, Amit Nagar." We do that. That's the town where Meher Baba was supposed to be. And asked if we could come to see him. And about 3 days later, we got a telegram back. And it said, "Don't come to Amit Nagar. If you love me wholeheartedly, you will feel my presence. If you remember me wholeheartedly, you will feel my presence wherever you are. Love, blessings to you, Meher Baba." And I remember Mick was really happy about this cable. Though it said, "Don't come," he was ecstatic about this cable. And he ran around, he showed it to everybody, and he was so happy about it. And Baba on the bottom gave us the name and address of a Baba lover in Delhi. And so we went and contacted this man, Mr. Kane. And Mr. Kane gave us a copy of God Speaks and a copy of the discourses. Apparently used to be published in just each discourse in an individual pamphlet. And so he gave us a discourse on the avatar and a discourse on the God-man and God Speaks. And Mick sat and read God Speaks in one sitting. He went to sleep in the night and he got up in the morning and he finished it. He read it in one day, basically. And I couldn't. My English, I wouldn't be able to read it. But at the same time, I also had no interest. This was sort of, at this point, Mick's thing. Anything that would make him happy, fine. But I wasn't really very interested in it. And then this Mr. Kane said that what we should do is we should write a letter to Meher Baba and tell him about ourselves, tell him who we are and what we're doing here. And so we did. That is, Mick did, and I would just sign it. And we told him, Mick just put in there that he was American, that I was German, that we'd been on the road for X amount of years, and he also told Baba that we were taking drugs. And a letter came back from Baba. It was written by Adi, Baba's secretary, and came back, and Baba said, "Stop taking drugs and go home." And that was like, what? Wait a minute. It seemed kind of hard to take. What does he mean, go home? He obviously doesn't understand the situation. So, but for a strange reason that really wasn't up to our willpower or anything, we stopped taking drugs that day. And we never related it to him. We never thought that this man who wrote us this letter had anything to do with it. We just sort of stopped, and it seemed like it was just the smart thing to do. We talked about it before, you know, we were going to stop before, and it's probably not healthy, and maybe we should stop, and so we stopped. And we didn't have we had no withdrawal symptoms or anything, though we had been taking opiates for quite a long time, but we didn't even have any more desire. It was so strange that someone would offer us a joint or something the next day, and we had no desire. It just, the desire was gone, but it really didn't seem to relate to Baba at all. I didn't. Whether Mick did, I don't know, but certainly it was just like, so we stopped taking drugs, big deal. And so we wrote back to Baba, and we explained to him that there was no home, that I could not come to the United States, and that we didn't want to go back to Germany. Because meanwhile, after I had left, the police had found out that I continued to sell part. And so they were, had come around my house looking for me. And so I definitely didn't want to go back to Germany. And we couldn't go to America. So India, here we were, and we really didn't have a home. So we wrote to Baba and explained that to him, and explained to him that we would have liked to go to America, but that we couldn't. And so we were going to stay in India. And Baba wrote back and he said, you try and to go to America. And so we said, oh, okay. And so we went to the American Embassy in Delhi. And I really did not, I mean, I thought he was, I guess, a saint or a holy man. I never really thought about what he was. But I didn't attribute any sort of miracles or powers or anything to him. For him to say, you try, just simply meant that, you try. So we went to the American Embassy in Delhi and asked for an immigration visa, and they had made me fill out all these forms and give them my passport and get a health checkup and photographs and more forms and endless forms. And then I got an immigration visa for the United States, and they forgot to ask me for my police record. In fact, to this day, they do not have my police record. And though it was strange, I mean, we had to admit it was strange that we're not dealing with Indians at the American consulate. This is the American government, and the police record is easily next to the birth certificate, the most important piece of paper that goes into an immigration visa. And it does not make any difference, by the way, if you're married to an American. If you have a record for drugs, then it's a problem. And so I didn't give, certainly, Baba any credit for it. I mean, I saw that there was no way that I could have given him any credit for it. He was 800 miles away. It just simply, they forgot. And maybe they just did. So now that we had an immigration visa to go to the United States, or that I did, we were very excited to go. And we were going to hitchhike to Europe and then fly from the cheapest airline was from Iceland to New York. I mean, from Luxembourg to New York, Icelandic airline. So we were going to hitchhike to Europe and we were going to leave fairly shortly and do that. And we wrote to Baba and we told him that we were leaving, that I got an immigration visa and we were going to the United States. And we got a special delivery letter from Baba, from Adi, saying, Mayor Baba wants to see you for 5 minutes only on March 7th, 1966 at 9 o'clock sharp. And Mick was so happy. He took this letter and he showed it to everybody. He was just, he was crying and he was just absolutely ecstatic. And I remember my reaction was, oh no, 800 miles that way, that 1600 miles round trip, we can't go from there to America, you gotta go by road, was from Delhi on through Pakistan. And I remember thinking, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go all the way there. But because Mick was so happy, I figured, all right, okay, that's wonderful. If he's happy, then that makes me happy, we'll go. So Adi had suggested what train he was going to meet us at Ahmednagar. But since we were hitchhikers, we hitchhiked until the last town before Ahmednagar and then took the train for the last few miles so we could meet Adi at the train. And so we arrived early, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning or something in Ahmednagar at the train station. And Adi was pretty obvious. He recognized us and we recognized him. And he put us into a 1947 Chevy, a two-tone blue Chevy, and he buzzed us out of Ahmednagar and onto a place where Baba lived called Mehrazad, which was 9 miles to the north of Ahmednagar. And now we were excited at this point. I remember one of my greatest anxieties of the day, actually, was that it was an Indian festival of Holi, and that's a festival during which Indians, mainly kids, throw red powder at each other as a decoration. It has something to do with Lord Krishna or something. I don't know if Digambar would be able to explain to you. And we'd been in India before doing that. And it, especially when they see Westerners, everybody just bombs you with this red powder. And I was thinking, oh my God, what are we going to look like? We're going to see this guy. We're going to have all this red powder all over us. But somehow we were spared. Nobody threw any red powder on us and we were clean. And So Adi drove us out to Mehrazan. And now this looked a little more like a place where a holy man would live. It was very plain, very simple, and just sort of adobe, a couple of little adobe structures and trees. And it was really very nice, very quiet. And Adi parked the car, and he made us sit on this bench. And he said, "You wait here, I'll go in and tell Baba that you've come." So he went inside, and we were sitting there. And Mick started getting really nervous. He said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do when we go in there? Are we going to throw ourselves at his feet? Or what are we going to do? We should have brought a coconut to put at his feet as a symbol of the mind and all these sort of Indian ritualistic kind of things. And we were sitting there and kind of nervously discussing, what are we going to do? Oh, my goodness. And Adi came out. And Adi said, "You're not to touch Meher Baba's feet. You're not to bow down to him. You're just to go in and sit." And so our what to do worry was sort of taken care of. And we walked in the door, and the first thing that I noticed was ahead of me, there were people sitting on the floor. And I remember just for an instant thinking, wow, these people, I don't know what I thought we were going to do. Somehow maybe I thought we were going to be alone with him or something. I'm not sure, but it was all so fast. But I remember noticing all these people, and they were all men. They were the men on. And I remember that one of them was fair, and that was Francis Brabazon, as I found out later. So I saw them, and then I turned to my right, and Baba was sitting in his chair over to the right, and Mick was walking ahead of me. And Baba looked up, and somewhere along the line, I presume for Mr. Kane in Delhi, did we find out that he does not speak. I knew that he was silent. And so Baba was sitting there, and he was going like this, making a sign like we should come and embrace him. So Mick went and embraced Baba, and Baba embraced him, and then I went, and Baba embraced me. And then he motioned for us to sit down on the wall opposite him. And Adi sat next to Baba on the floor, and then all these men were down there. And then someone started talking, sitting kind of next to me a little ways down, and that was, I later found out, Erich. I didn't know who Erich was, I just heard this voice coming from there, and Baba was gesturing, and Erich was speaking. And so I just kind of sat, and I had a look at him, and the thing that I noticed most was that he was very small. He was not a big man at all. His chair sort of almost came up around him. It's not a big chair either, but he just seemed like a very small man. And he was very pale. And his complexion was sort of not, didn't look healthy. He looked sort of kind of grayish almost. And he just looked like he was unhealthy, and he was tired and old. And somehow I was surprised at that. I don't know what I had expected. And so he started gesturing, and Erich started talking, and he asked, "How did we sleep?" And we said, "Oh, fine, fine." When in fact, we really didn't sleep at all because we took that train and we'd hitchhiked and so on. But we forgot. And so we said, "Fine, fine, Baba." And he looked at Mick and he said, "Are you well? You look very thin." And Mick said, "Yes, I'm well. I'm well. This is my normal weight." And Baba said, "You should eat more chapatis." And his sign for chapatis was like that. And I forgot just to say that when we got a letter from Baba saying that we could come to see him, Mick got himself some normal clothes, and he gave his orange robes. We walked down the street, and there was a beggar sitting there, and he dropped his orange robes into the beggar's thing. And that was the end of the orange robes. He was wearing normal clothes. And so here we are. Baba's asking how we are, how our health is, and we told him that we were vegetarians, which we were at the time. And as he was talking, as we were sitting there looking at him, he really started to look quite different, actually. He wasn't looking so tired and so old and so, you know, ill anymore. His eyes were so powerful, or so, I don't know what.